This is Addiction Medicine Journal Club. I'm Dr. Sonia Del Tredici.
And I'm Dr. John Keenan.
We believe that addiction is a disease that can be treated, and we want to help you stay up to date with the latest research that you can use in your addiction medicine practice. John, how are you doing tonight?
Good. Still recovering from a man cold.
Didn't we talk about that last episode?
It's almost like that they're recorded in sequence.
Almost as if we recorded both episodes on the same evening.
Yeah, almost.
So, John, why don't you tell our listeners what we're going to do in this episode?
This is the second part of our special episode. If you listen to part one, you know that we went back through the archives, looking at all the articles reviewed and chose the 10 that have made the biggest impact on our individual practices. We're going to be a little vulnerable here. We're discussing kind of actual cases that occurred in our office and what we used to do and how we've kind of changed our practice based upon some newer articles we've reviewed.
All right. Ready to dive right in?
Let's do it.
All right. I'm going to tell you about a patient, and I actually saw that this patient today. And so, spoiler alert, patient is doing amazing. But he's a 29-year-old man with opioid use disorder, and he reports after about 3 months of treatment that he's still having terrible cravings while taking 16 milligrams of buprenorphine naloxone combo product daily. He's taken extra of the buprenorphine naloxone, and he ran out of his prescription early, and he also is still using cocaine. So really still having cravings for opioids, running out of his buprenorphine early, and using cocaine. So what I used to tell a patient in this situation, I'd say 16 milligrams a day is the maximum dose of buprenorphine. Almost all of your receptors are probably blocked. I don't know why you're still having cravings. Let's try to find another way to address your symptoms. Maybe it's anxiety or something causing them. Then I read an article that came out in JAMA Network Open in 2023 called Buprenorphine Dose and Time to Discontinuation Among Patients with Opioid Use Disorder in the Era of Fentanyl. So, John, how often have you told people that 16 milligrams a day is the maximum dose of buprenorphine?
In my early career, all the time. Although, like, I think as I've gone along further, that has not always been the case. And yeah, so you are right, though. I think initially when I started, mostly because insurance guides you, right? A lot of times that's kind of the max they cap before you have to kind of force another authorization through. I would always stop at 16. But I do have many patients that have come to me on 24. I used to be a little bit more suspicious about it. Now, I think some people do legitimately need it. And then you see some research where there's studies of people like with doses of 36 and 40 milligrams, like way beyond that. And I'm like, whoa, what are they doing with that? You know, when I see that, that makes me feel a little bit better about the 24.
Right. So this study addressed that kind of question. So the summary of the clinical question is, what is the association between buprenorphine dose and retention and treatment in the era of fentanyl? So modern data. It was a retrospective cohort study, including everybody in the state of Rhode Island who initiated buprenorphine in a four-year period from 2016 to 2020, and this was 6,499 people. They compared patients on various initial daily doses of buprenorphine, so 8, 16, and 24 milligrams, and this is their sort of starting dose. And the primary outcome was time to treatment discontinuation in the 180 days after buprenorphine initiation. So again, you could be started on 8, 16, or 24 milligrams of buprenorphine. And how long were you able to stay in treatment based on your initial dose? So spoiler alert, the 24 milligram dose did better than the 16 milligram and the 8 milligram dose. So those who were started on 24 milligrams of buprenorphine were more likely to be in treatment at 6 months. About 47% were still in treatment at 6 months, whereas the 16 milligram dose, only 41% were still in treatment at 6 months. So not a huge difference. The number needed to treat of 16 versus 24 milligrams to keep someone in treatment for 180 days is 17. So you'd have to switch 17 patients from 16 to 24 milligrams to keep one person in treatment for 6 months. So, you know, a number needed to treat of 17 isn't great, but it's not bad compared to some of the interventions we do. The study also showed that the 24 milligram dose group had less need for a dose change. The 16 milligram dose group, 39% required a dose change, and most of that was dosing upward to 24 milligrams. And the average time to dose change in that 16 milligram group was about 15 days. So within 2 weeks, on average, people, 40% of the patients had had to change their dose. Whereas in the 24 milligram group, the average time to dose change was 20 days, and it was only 26% of patients needed a dose change. So basically, people who were started on the higher dose of buprenorphine, the 24 milligrams, had a better chance of staying in treatment and also had a lower chance of needing a dose adjustment pretty quickly after starting treatment. So again, with our case, a 29-year-old man with opioid use disorder who's having cravings and still using other drugs, now I just say, hey, let's up that dose to 24 milligrams and maybe you'll feel better. And I have no hesitation about doing that.
Yeah, this is something that I feel like with time, it doesn't give me any heartburn anymore, right? Especially if someone's saying the word cravings to me, like that to me is just surrogate for risk. I do think sometimes I still get in these nebulous situations where like people want to up the dose for other reasons, like, you know, they're a little more tired lately. And sometimes I'll kind of try to explore that a little bit more. But if someone's saying cravings, going to 24 seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah. And I think because many of our patients have been using illicit fentanyl, and those sort of massive doses of opioids that you get from illicit fentanyl use have caused just a huge downregulation of your opioid receptors. You kind of don't have that many opioid receptors anymore. And so you need higher doses of buprenorphine to activate them. So that old quote of, oh, like 90%+ of your receptors are activated at 60 milligrams of buprenorphine no longer holds true.
So the next case I have is a 21-year-old college student with a history of generalized anxiety disorder who vapes daily visits me for their yearly physical. Towards the end of the appointment, they express interest in quitting vaping and inquire about trying varenicline for cessation. So what I used to do is I would explain to the patient that my usual approach to vaping cessation involves gradually reducing the nicotine concentration in vape products on a weekly basis, like a self-wean. Although there's limited data on varenicline for vaping cessation, if they're willing to consider it its off-label use, we could give it a try. So relatively no harm. I read this article. It's called Varenicline and Counseling for Vaping Cessation, a double-blind, randomized, parallel group, placebo-controlled trial from BMC from July 2023. The clinical question is, what is the efficacy and safety of varenicline? That's 1 milligram twice daily administered for 12 weeks and followed by an additional 12-week follow-up after discontinuation, combined with vaping cessation in daily, exclusively electronic cigarette users intending to quit vaping. So the study design, this was a double-blind, randomized, parallel group, placebo-controlled trial comparing the safety and efficacy of combining varenicline versus placebo with vaping cessation counseling on 140 adult participants aged 18 and above. This study was conducted from April 2018 to September 2022. So a little bit about the study. At visit one, patients were assessed for study inclusion and randomized to a study or control group if they met the criteria. The control group received a placebo pill plus weekly tobacco cessation counseling sessions. And these were very kind of like brief interventions. So only a couple minutes per cessation counseling. The intervention group got varenicline with the weekly tobacco cessation counseling as well. They had weekly visits for 12 weeks. And in each of these weekly visits, they had tobacco cessation counseling. They got exhaled carbon monoxide levels. They had adverse event reporting and they received the study drug or the blinded drug. I really like this part of it because, you know, self-report's good, but I like the fact they added in the exhaled carbon monoxide level as kind of like a biochemically validated marker of nicotine use. After another 12 weeks of non-treatment, a follow-up visit occurred at 24 weeks where data was recollected. The primary efficacy endpoint was proportion of subjects with continuous abstinence from vaping between weeks 4 to 12. They did that based upon the exhaled carbon monoxide level, salivary cotinine level, and then self-reported abstinence. The secondary efficacy endpoint was the proportion of subjects with continuous abstinence from vaping between weeks 4 to 24, also with salivary cotinine level, carbon monoxide levels, and then self-reported abstinence. They also did a 7-day point prevalence of abstinence between weeks 12 and 24. And the last thing they looked at was safety endpoint. So adverse events and serious adverse events, which they defined as death, life-threatening reaction, hospitalization, disability, or incapacity. So a little bit about the participants before I get through about the outcomes. So out of 371 subjects that kind of enrolled, only 140, which is 37.7%, were randomized to the trial. So the most common reason for exclusion was that most of these were dual users. They smoked cigarettes and vaped. So they really kind of pared this down just to the vaping-only participants. 80.7% of those patients did actually complete the full 12-week intervention. Most of them had tried to quit vaping at least once. They were highly motivated on two counts. One is they would do a visual analog scale. So like 1 to 10, what's their motivation to quit? And they were all greater than 8. They also had to self-reduce 50% of their vape consumption before the committing to the target quit date. So they kind of tapered down before this even started. So really, really motivated patients. The most common reason for wanting to quit was the concern about potential health risk of long-term e-cigarette use, which was 72.9%. And I think I always find that very interesting because they talk about like nocebo effect, and vaping is definitely not a healthy habit, but it's interesting with like kind of the media that patients have a very elevated sense of risk with the use of these products. They're not healthy to begin with, but probably they're perceived as more riskier than they actually probably are.
Yeah, I can't tell you the number of patients who, when I talk to them about vaping, say, oh, well, it's just as bad. I've heard it's worse than smoking, or I've heard it's just as bad as smoking. You know, there is that perception out there.
It was those case reports of those vaping associated lung injuries that were in the news, which were like there was several cases, but it makes it sound like that everyone was having this. So results here. So vaping abstinence rates, biochemically validated continuous abstinence rates were higher for varenicline than placebo at all time points. And actually it about doubled your chance of cessation. When you look at like the data for cigarette use, it about triples your chances of cessation in most of the data I've seen. Here it's about double. So it went from 20 to 40% at week 4 to 12. And then on week 4 to 24, which is the end of the trial, 17.2 to 34.3%. 7-day point prevalence of vaping abstinence was also higher for varenicline than placebo at each time point. And it was about double again at week 4. 41.4% were abstinent in the varenicline group, 22.9% in the placebo, 40% versus 20% at week 12, 34.3% versus 17.2% at week 24. Not surprising when they looked at factors affecting abstinence rates. If you had a cohabitant vapor in your house, your odds of success were reduced by approximately 70%. And if you had a higher Bex anxiety inventory score, also reduced your odds of success. So anxious people that lived with co-vapers, it was more difficult for you to quit. The adverse events, more serious adverse events occurred in the varenicline group than the placebo group. So, or not more serious, just more total adverse events. 256 versus 154. Adverse events rarely led to discontinuation. So only 2 patients discontinued the varenicline and 1 the placebo drug. Surprisingly, the most common adverse events were nausea. So that was 19.9% in the varenicline group, which is a common side effect. I hear about nausea all the time. I did find it amusing that 12.3% of the patients receiving the placebo pill also reported nausea. The second most common adverse event has never been told to me by a patient. It's flatulence. It's 6.9% versus 3.9% were having flatulence. And I'll be honest with you, I've never heard a patient tell me they had flatulence with varenicline.
They probably just like, they just don't connect it, you know? I've had patients who've had a cough from lisinopril for like 14 years.
Yeah.
And they never put 2 and 2 together because they just had no, in their mind, there could be no connection between coughing and a blood pressure medicine. I think it's the same. People just probably don't even think there's any connection, so they don't even bring it up as a potential side effect. And I don't want to ask about it because I don't want to like discourage people from taking varenicline.
And then abnormal dreams were the next most common side effect. And I hear about that all the time, 6.5% in the varenicline group. Non-significant weight gain occurred in all subjects. So, you know, this always comes up. This is the medicine, it's not. But smoking cessation is associated with weight gain. It's an appetite suppressant. So going back to this case, what do I do now? Recognizing that in this particular case, the patient has a very high level of motivation, just like in this study, I do propose using varenicline along with tobacco cessation counseling or nicotine cessation counseling as a combination definitely boosts his likelihood of quitting vaping. And I do so without really hesitancy. It's still off-label and I would still document that, but I would have no second thoughts about offering that product.
Yeah, no, me neither. Okay, so here's our case. This is a 42-year-old man with opioid use disorder, and he's just been diagnosed with hepatitis C by his primary care doctor who screened him for hep C. He continues, though, to struggle with IV drugs, and he's just starting outpatient treatment with buprenorphine, but it hasn't really, you know, hasn't stabilized yet, so still using some IV drugs. So what I used to do with a patient in this situation, I'd say, let's wait on the HCV treatment until you're not using IV drugs. After you're stable, then I can refer you to GI, and I'm sure they'll get you in someday. It's probably a while. They're kind of backed up. They'll call you, but don't change your phone number because they're going to call you on your cell phone. And can you check your portal messages? You have the patient portal, right? And you have transportation because they don't do video visits, but we're definitely going to get this taken care of. You know, it just was kind of a losing battle. And then I read this article titled Patient-Centered Models of Hepatitis C Treatment for People Who Inject Drugs, and it was a multi-center pragmatic randomized trial. This was put out by a group called the HERO Study Group, and it was published in the Lancet Gastroenterology and Hepatology in December 2022. So this was a pragmatic randomized trial comparing two different models of hepatitis C care. They did a modified directly observed therapy, meaning somebody watched the patient take most of the doses, or if they didn't watch the patient took them kind of on video and someone watched that video, or taking the meds like normal, but with support from patient navigators who were specially trained in hepatitis C care. The population was 755 people with hepatitis C who were injecting drugs at least within the last 90 days, and most of them had injected within the past 30 days of entering this study. 87% were single or lived alone. 54% did not have their own home or apartment. 59% had no transportation, and 65% were unemployed. So again, this is a population of people who are injecting drugs, single, without the support of a spouse, many homeless or having to crash in someone else's home, without transportation, without jobs. So a very difficult population with a lot of challenges and barriers. The intervention was treatment of Hep C. So everybody was given Sofosbuvir or Velpatasvir once daily for 12 weeks. This is standard treatment for hepatitis C. And this is not a study of whether you should treat Hep C or not, you know, comparing people who got treatment and who didn't. There is no question that treating hepatitis C cures hepatitis C. So every single person in this study was given treatment for hepatitis C. And what they were randomized to was whether they got this directly observed treatment, which is pretty high intensity to do any kind of directly observed therapy, or take-home medicine, you know, like a prescription for a month's worth or whatever, supported by a trained hepatitis C patient navigator. The patients had research visits every 4 weeks, so at weeks 4, 8, and 12. And then they were seen again every 12 weeks for up to 168 weeks, which is about 3 years. And they did hepatitis C PCR and urine drug screens at every visit to assess continued drug use and also assess hepatitis C cure or potential for reinfection. Again, the primary outcome was sustained virologic response, meaning your hepatitis C was gone somewhere between 70 and 365 days after the end of treatment. So basically, this is a study of two different treatment models of Hep C. Both models were the same. That's the result. Both models cured Hep C at the same rate. But that's not the interesting part of this study because I don't have either model available to me. I have neither patient navigators nor staff who's going to directly observe my patients taking hepatitis C medication. The most interesting thing to me in this study was the incredible success the researchers had in curing hepatitis C in this population. Again, this is most evident on a slide. You know, you have to see this graph, but I'm going to try to describe it. So of the patients who started the study, about 81% of them progressed to starting treatment. So of the people who were enrolled, about 81% got a first dose of Hep C meds. Of those patients, about 82% completed treatment. And of those, about 83% got their blood checked and achieved sustained virologic response. So if you add all those together, between 55 and 60% of the patients in this study had their hepatitis C cured. And again, this is a super difficult to work with population with a ton of barriers, and 60% of them had their Hep C cured. And I was like, that's pretty amazing. And I don't see why I can't do this myself. And so the reason this article changed my practice is it inspired me to start a quality improvement project to treat hepatitis C in primary care, even in my very unstable patients. So again, our case, our 42-year-old man struggling with opioid use disorder and IV drug use who has hepatitis C, now I say, we can treat your hepatitis C. We're going to do it right now. We just need a few more labs. Then I'll order the medication. We'll have it sent to your home and we will get this taken care of. So, John, how much success do you have in treating hepatitis C in your patients with opioid use disorder?
I treat it pretty frequently now. And, you know, I've been trying to get away with less and less in terms of what I'm submitting for the authorization for these medicines, because they really are, I hate to use the word idiot proof, but it's easy, right? You basically have Pepsi and Coke. You have two drugs that are basically pangenotypic. One's an 8-week course, one's a 12-week course. You know, all my patients with opioid use disorder, I get baseline labs regarding like a CMP, a chronic HEP profile, which has HEP C plus HEP B, an HIV. And the only other thing that you need is a CBC to submit for a Fib4 score. And, you know, I just do that now on everyone out the gate, and I submit right away, and I get approval of them on treatment within like 2 weeks. And so I've kind of deferred a lot of the additional stuff just to try to streamline people into treatment, and it really works.
Well, and I think you're ahead of the curve on that. I'm seeing research on hepatitis C come out where people are doing less and less and less and still having success in curing hep C. So now there are protocols where you do a finger stick hep C test, and if it's positive, you start treatment right there.
I'm not that far ahead.
Soon.
I just know that the more lab work I make people go back for in this population, and the more testing with ultrasounds and things like that, it just ain't going to happen.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Okay, cool. Next case. I like this article a lot. So this one's kind of fun, I think. So a 23-year-old male with a history of opioid use disorder, methamphetamine use disorder, PTSD, anxiety with panic attacks, neuropathy NOS, and ADHD presents for a new patient appointment.
a 15-minute new patient appointment, probably, right?
Yeah. He takes buprenorphine 16 milligrams daily. He has a naloxone allergy, so he can't be on the combination product. He's on Adderall IR 25 milligrams twice daily. He takes gabapentin 800 milligrams TID for that neuropathy. And he's on a prazolam a milligram 3 times daily because all SSRIs are ineffective. His urine drug screen is positive for buprenorphine and amphetamine and negative for benzodiazepines. He needs refills for all of these medications today because he just ran out.
Mm.
Have you ever seen this patient?
Wait, did I refer him to you?
Yeah. So what I used to do is I would explain to the patient the risks of respiratory depression associated with co-prescribing benzodiazepines and buprenorphine. I decide to maintain the gabapentin, initiate a trial of an SSRI that they have not tried before. The two I always have success with are desvenlafaxine, that's an SNRI, and then fluvoxamine. No one's ever tried those two for some reason, and so I always pull those out of my back pocket. I begin a 1-month taper of the alprazolam, and I agree to refill the Adderall once I get confirmation of the ADHD diagnosis. And to be quite transparent, I probably would try to switch them to lisdexamfetamine since it has less of an abuse potential.
Mm-hmm.
I then read this article. It was called Non-Fatal Overdose Risk Associated with Prescribing Opioid Agonists Concurrently with Other Medications. And it's a cohort study conducted using linked primary care, secondary care, and mortality records from addiction, August 2023. What's your thoughts on that approach, Sonia?
Well, I think you did pretty good. You got a lot done in 15 minutes here with this patient. You know, but it's true. And I don't blame patients who are being prescribed these medications that are habit forming, and then they have to switch doctors for whatever reason. And they show up with the assumption that the new doctor would do the same thing the old doctor does. And it puts everybody in a really sticky situation, especially if the medications are unsafe. We see that in our residency clinic all the time because we take new patients every day. And again, I don't blame the patients for wanting to continue their meds, especially if the meds are giving them some benefit. But as a doctor, you're putting your name, you're signing on the dotted line here. And if there is an adverse outcome and someone were to ask you, or you were to just ask yourself, how come you prescribed these meds that you knew were high risk without trying something else? You know, what are you going to say? So it's just a really tough situation. And we don't see it as much as we used to with, you know, sort of tighter restrictions on controlled substances. But we still see patients like this.
I think I see more overdoses than the average person because of the nature of kind of the population I take care of. And sadly, I still do get a couple overdose deaths a year. And oftentimes they're new patients kind of with this benzodiazepine combination. At least anecdotally, that's what I see the most. And it's sad and tragic because they're young and,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, it's unnecessary.
Yeah.
So the clinical question here is, what is the non-fatal overdose risk associated with co-prescription of opioid agonist treatment? So that's like methadone or buprenorphine with high-risk drugs. And they looked at benzodiazepines, antipsychotics, antidepressants, gabapentinoids, Z-drugs, or sleep meds, and opioids. Second, what was the difference in non-fatal overdose risk between periods of time when opioid agonist therapy was co-prescribed with other drugs compared to periods of time involving only the opioid agonist? And finally, what is the difference in overdose risk between methadone and buprenorphine recipients among OAT recipients receiving these higher risk medications? So was one more likely to result in overdose than the other? The study was a retrospective cohort study utilizing anonymous longitudinal electronic health records from general practice in the clinical practice research data link. And that basically narrowed it down to 20,898 patients aged 18 and above receiving methadone or buprenorphine between January of 1998 and December of 2017. And it was linked to these hospital episode statistics admitted patients. It's called HES APC records, neighborhood and practice level index of multiple deprivation quintiles and mortality data from the Office of National Statistics. So basically, it was linking kind of pharmacy data, outpatient prescribing data with hospital encounters. So trying to link those three intersections. The exposure was an opioid agonist prescription with receipt of at least one of the drugs of interest. They considered you being positive within 7 days for a benzodiazepine, a Z drug, or opioids. And this is kind of consistent with UK prescribing guidelines, which is where this study was conducted. Gabapentinoids, antipsychotics, or antidepressants, they chose 14 days as your exposure window. Unexposed were periods of time when you were not receiving any of these medications in that 7 or 14 day window, only receiving an opioid agonist. And the outcome of interest was non-fatal overdose, and they derived that from ICD-10 codes from this HES APC database. So when you look at the results kind of grossly, 4,512 out of 20,898, that's 21.6% of patients experience a non-fatal overdose. So one in five, or a little bit more than one in five, had an overdose.
Ugh, that's so many. Ugh.
Yeah. But what you found is like there was a subgroup that just overdosing all the time. So like 54% of patients had more than one, of the ones that overdosed had more than one overdose. Mm-hmm. 12,973 overdoses resulted in generation of a hospitalization record. And then out of those hospitalization records, 29% were associated with co-prescription of one of these high-risk medications. I redid the order of the table, but here's kind of like in descending order of your highest risk co-prescribed medication. Here's kind of what really struck me. They did this weighted relative risk or weighted rate ratio, and the highest was actually gabapentinoids, which does that surprise you?
Yes, it totally surprised me.
That surprised me quite a bit. And that was the highest with a WRR of 2.22. Behind that was antipsychotics. I could see that one. That was a WRR of 1.85, followed by the Z drugs, which is 1.6, then benzodiazepines of 1.45, opioids of 1.28, and antidepressants had no increased association with overdose.
I have to say the antipsychotics surprised me as well. I mean, I see a lot of side effects to antipsychotics. Patients complain about the weight gain, the sedation, fuzzy thinking, but I hadn't really thought about them in terms of overdose risk because I don't think of them as contributing to respiratory depression. But I guess I was wrong.
At least in this trial or in this database. Mm-hmm. There was no statistically significant difference between co-prescribed drug of interest and OAT modality. So like, you know, I would have thought that methadone would have been higher risk just because it's a pure agonist. There really was no statistically significant difference between whether it was buprenorphine or methadone. So both when co-prescribed with these other medications presented a risk. So kind of like revisiting this case, what would I do now? You know, this is one where like I think a little differently. I'm not sure how much I do differently, but I do think about it differently. You know, I advise the patient against co-prescribing benzodiazepines and buprenorphine due to risk of respiratory suppression. That's just one area I haven't been comfortable in primary care with, prescribing like high-dose benzos with opioid agonists. I initiate a trial of SSRI like I would do before an alprazolam taper. I typically do treat P people that have a true diagnosis of ADHD. Now, knowing that that's not a life-sustaining medication, so if it's being abused, it will be discontinued, unlike some of the other medications. Regarding the gabapentin, you know, instead of just refilling it nonchalantly, I do now have a discussion with them regarding risk of overdose and respiratory suppression. If they are agreeable, either a dose reduction or tapering, since it is dose dependent, can be helpful, or I'll at least document the discussion and kind of refill the medication with them acknowledging that risk.
I mean, I go a little further than you do with the gabapentin. I mean, I'm alarmed by how gabapentin is treated as a cure-all for all of these symptoms that we don't have great answers to in medicine. So depression, anxiety, all kinds of pain, like I see people giving gabapentin for low back pain and for neck pain and all kinds of pain and for sleep. And all of my patients with opioid use disorder appear to be given gabapentin, which they find effective for whatever reason, because I think it has that kind of sedating effect. And of course, those GABAergic effects that you would otherwise get from alcohol and other illicit sedatives.
Neuropathy NOS.
I don't see why any 23-year-old who appears healthy should have neuropathy. I mean, I take peripheral neuropathy seriously, but I'm not going to prescribe gabapentin without a diagnosis. I say, well, we got to test you. Why do you have neuropathy? You know, we need to work it up. We need labs. A 23-year-old with significant neuropathy requiring gabapentin, in my mind, as an internist, needs a workup for neurologic disease. But I honestly find that the neuropathy symptoms are often related to other things and aren't really peripheral neuropathy. So I think I'm a little harsher than you are on the gabapentin.
You know, I think I'm a little bit laxer about it, probably because, like, I think that there is data about it for as an adjunct for panic attacks or panic disorder. So, like, and there, that's like real data as an add-on to an SSRI. And a lot of people do have PTSD, and I've often viewed it kind of as a safer drug than benzos. Now, this would kind of point the other way, right? So it has made me reconsider some of my practice, but that's kind of the niche I found it kind of most useful for. The neuropathy one is, you're right, I'm not sure how so many 18-year-olds have neuropathy. I'm just not sure it's the hill I'm going to die on.
All right. Ready for the last article?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. And just a note, your pen is, you're clicking your pen a lot.
No, you hate it when I do that.
Sorry, it gets in the sound. It's really loud. They get you a box of Bic pens that don't click for Christmas. Anyway, sorry, Aaron, cut that out, please.
Leave it.
Oh, you can make an editorial decision. All right. Last article. Here's my case. A 55-year-old man who uses IV fentanyl presents to the office asking about treatment options for his opioid use disorder, basically saying he needs treatment. He has a recent hospitalization for an overdose, another recent hospitalization for having a seizure while driving without a license, leading to a car accident and possible criminal charges. He and his family are also facing eviction from their home, and he has a knee injury for some reason, not even sure why, making it really hard for him to walk, and he's in terrible pain. So life is in chaos. Everything is going wrong, and he's using IV drugs. And what I used to do with a situation like this is say, maybe you should go to rehab. And that's why I would recommend inpatient treatment for a patient like this using IV drugs whose life is deteriorating and everything is falling down around them. Would you ever recommend inpatient treatment for people like this, John?
I've always heard one of our kind of addiction gurus in the group always use the word air quotes when he would say higher level of care. And I always kind of like, that was always triggering for me early on. And now I kind of get it. I feel like at times when I offer that, I'm almost just feel like I'm at a point where I just have nothing to offer. And I'm not sure if I'm even helping. It's more like you're throwing something to the end zone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. So the article that influenced my thinking in this area was called Receipt of Opioid Use Disorder Treatments Prior to Fatal Overdose in Comparison to No Treatment in Connecticut, 2016 to 2017. This was published in the Journal of Drug and Alcohol Dependence, January 1st, 2024. So this is the most recent article that we're presenting here. So the clinical question is, in patients with a fatal overdose involving opioids, what is the incidence rate and relative risk of exposure of different treatments for opioid use disorder? So in 2016, the governor of Connecticut convened an expert panel to determine the evidence-based strategies to reduce the impact of opioids. The study looked at all patients in Connecticut who had opioid use disorder and all the people who had died, which was 965 patients, of an opioid-related cause in the years 2016 to 2017. The exposure in this study was treatment, so treatment with buprenorphine, treatment with methadone, a short-term inpatient treatment, which was less than 14 days, which we might call detox, a long-term inpatient treatment, so anything greater than 14 days, which we might call rehab. They compared this exposure to treatment to no treatment, or at least none of the above treatments. So the study didn't include things like psychosocial counseling, groups, mutual support groups, AA or Narcotics Anonymous. They were not included in the study because they're not tracked by the state. And the outcome was fatal opioid-related poisonings, or overdoses, as we would call them. And so the results, there were four main results. First one was incidence of death after treatment exposure per 1,000 patients exposed. So methadone had 6 deaths per 1,000 patients exposed. Buprenorphine, 6.5 deaths per 1,000 patients. No treatment at all. So people who didn't get any treatment, 9.8 deaths per 1,000. And inpatient treatment of any duration, 17.4 deaths per 1,000. So inpatient treatment was the worst, and it was the most risky, even more than getting no treatment at all. If you like relative risks, here's some relative risk. I won't say data. Here's some putting the data in terms of relative risks. So compared to no treatment at all, methadone and buprenorphine was associated with a reduced risk of death. Relative risk was 0.62 for methadone and 0.66 for buprenorphine. Compared to no treatment at all, inpatient treatment of any duration was associated with a higher risk of death, with a relative risk of 1.67. So inpatient treatment was worse than no treatment at all. Compared to methadone, inpatient treatment of any duration was associated with a higher risk of death, with a relative risk of 2.87, so almost a 3 times higher rate of death. And the authors say, and I'm just going to quote them, this is an unacceptably high probability for treatments that are purported to benefit patients with opiate use disorder and likely to be paid for by public tax revenues. Result 3, exposure to short and long-term inpatient treatment provided no protection against fatal opioid poisoning. Non-medication treatment might have produced worse outcomes than no treatment whatsoever. And finally, exposure to medication treatment, even if treatment was not continued, reduced the risk of opioid-related deaths. So you didn't just have your rate of death reduced while you were on treatment with buprenorphine or methadone. It reduced your risk of death even after you had discontinued treatment. So, John, what did you think of those results?
I mean, not unsurprising, unfortunately. I don't know. I've always kind of referred to now kind of extending someone to inpatient, almost like respite care for the treatment team. But I don't think it's in the patient's best interest, right? What do you do then with this group?
Well, here's what I do now. Instead of suggesting rehab... what do I do?
I jumped ahead. Sorry.
instead of suggesting inpatient rehab now, I would say to this patient, and I did say to this patient, do you want to get started on buprenorphine now? Or would you like us to get you an appointment for methadone? Let's not consider inpatient treatment at this time. And so I'm always willing, if people want to go to inpatient, I mean, I had a patient who went to inpatient treatment today, and I think it might be good for him. If someone wants to go, like, that's great. It will keep you safe for 30 days. It will maybe give you some tools. It will hopefully start you on medication for opiate use disorder, and you will be discharged on that medication and given an outpatient visit with your provider so it can get you over that hump of getting started on medication. So if anyone wants to go, I'm not against it, but I just feel like I can no longer recommend it as this is what you should do. If someone asks me what they should do, I say you should go on buprenorphine or methadone, and that's the most effective treatment.
Yeah, it seems like more and more you read, it's like in terms of like mortality, harm reduction, it's the meds, right? And I mean, like the other stuff seems like we put so much money into it from a combating the fentanyl crisis. And I know it's incredibly controversial in the recovery community because it's like a difference between like harm reduction versus like these other things focus more on like true total abstinence-based recovery systems. And, you know, is one better than the other? And I think that's probably not where everyone's at, right? But certainly the medications make a big difference here, and sending someone to inpatient just because their symptoms are severe. I think if anything, it's a time to intensify with medication right out the bat. And you can do that immediately, right?
Yeah. Well, and I just feel like if all the money that we spent on our inpatient drug treatment centers, and, you know, I mean, it costs a lot to send someone to inpatient treatment for 30 days. It's a lot of money. Think how many outpatient treatment navigators we could hire, whose whole job it was to help shepherd people through outpatient treatment and help them get their lives back in order. Well, thank you everyone for listening to this special episode of the Addiction Medicine Journal Club. We really would like to know which articles have changed your practice, and maybe we'll be able to profile them on future episodes. So send them to us on Instagram, Facebook, Threads, YouTube, Spotify, email, all the social medias, or you can join our Facebook group. The links will be in the show notes. Our original theme music was composed and performed by Benjamin Kennedy, audio editing by Aaron McHugh. We have CME support from MyCares, and we are produced by Dr. Patrick Beeman and Ars Longa Media. Addiction Medicine Journal Club is intended for educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views expressed here are our own and do not necessarily reflect those of our employers or the authors of the articles we review. All patient information has been modified to protect their identities. Thank you for being part of the conversation. Have a great day.